Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with Peter Laufer, the James Wallace Chair Professor in Journalism at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication. A longtime talk radio consultant, he has developed several international news broadcasting projects, including radio programs for National Geographic, Washington Monthly, and Mother Jones.
Peter is the author of many books, including Slow News, a manifesto for the critical news consumer, and Dreaming in Turtle, a journey through the passion, profit, and peril of our most coveted prehistoric creatures. His next book, Up Against the Wall, The Case for Opening the Mexican-American Border, comes out this fall.
Peter is a deep believer in so many of the things we hold close to our hearts here at The Slowdown, including conversation, observation, and the relentless pursuit of truth. He has also long studied and thought about our relationship as humans to the rest of the natural world, and on top of that is one of the earliest visionaries of the slow news movement. We're so thrilled to be able to speak with him today. Let's get him on the line. Hi, Peter. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you and to see the squalor in your bedroom.
I wanted to start with just what's on the top of your mind right now.
It's impossible for the virus not to be top of mind right now. Just because before we started talking, I was looking at the Times here, and it's sobering to the point of it being very difficult to transcend.
Mm. How have you personally been dealing with the quarantine and spending your time during the quarantine?
I'm extraordinarily fortunate. I am in the middle of the production of a book, and that takes my creative energy and my time. And I am in Oregon. And so far, although the numbers are increasing, we have been an oasis in the devastation that America faces.
Mm. Why do you think that is?
Well, there are a bunch of factors. One of them is the relative rural reality of the state. Another is relatively early on, the government stuffed down or attempted to made the rules that were followed by an awful lot of people. And now with the same kind of openings that have been going on in other places in the country, the numbers have been going up. And we have the idiots who decide to make a political statement, or so they think, by walking around spitting and coughing on the rest of us without masks.
Mm.
The usual suspects.
Right.
But to go back to your personal question, I'm nicely isolated in this college town that supposedly is forward thinking.
Mm. Being an Oregonian, I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the current state of things in Portland?
Well, it's really intriguing to see us Oregonians, and Portland in particular, up the road from me here, being manipulated and used by, speaking of idiots, the criminal in the White House. The thing that I keep thinking about is what goes through the minds of the soldiers. That's really what they are. How can they get up in the morning and put on that gear and go into the streets and act in the manner they are acting against majority, vast majority, peaceful demonstrators exercising First Amendment rights and common sense? And the nonsense about them being needed in the streets, the Federals, because of violence is absurd. The local cops obviously can deal with it. And then that brings to mind how many of those who are perpetrating inappropriate acts are agents provocateur.
Mm.
Because nothing is beyond the current occupants of the White House in terms of self-serving criminal behavior.
How are you feeling about November? Do you think he's going to be able to stick it out?
I don't think we can figure that. There's so many contingencies. My biggest concern, I think, is that he will be resoundingly defeated, and I hope that that's the case. And then he is in there from Election Day until Inauguration Day. And what are we going to face then when you figure what we're facing currently? Let's talk about something that isn't so depressing.
I know. Well, let's talk about speed and story.
Okay.
So there's been this amazing series of thoughts that people have had since March, since this pandemic, that are just lying in great contrast to how they were thinking beforehand. I'm curious from you how we're going to not forget as we move out of this. How are we going to sort of memorialize and learn from the disaster?
In terms of the positive things that are happening, like cooking and hanging out with the wife and being nice to the kids. And yeah, how are we going to do that? We're going to try not to selfishly slide back into old patterns.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll be the old two steps forward, one step back, but we'll still be one step further than we were prior. I don't know. We're so in the middle of it still. I'm not sure we're able to answer that question collectively yet. And one of the things, you're depressing me again, one of the things that we do see when these openings occur is such immediate backsliding by so many people to ludicrous behavior.
Yeah. Well, I think story out of this is going to be super important. You know, people that are helping us understand the thinking positively that was happening during this time that seems to get lost when we go back to normal.
Yeah. But then what is the balance between story having lasting appeal versus story helping us escape from, as we started the conversation, when you said, what am I thinking about? What else is there to think about? It's so hard to not think about everything in the context of this overwhelming problem. So will we want story about what we've just been through, even a year or two hence, or would we want escapism or at least a different story?
I want to ask you a bit about slow news. Can you help define that and help us understand what slow news actually is?
Yeah, I've been struggling with answering that question for about a dozen years now since I wrote the book, Slow News. My default answer is good journalism. And slow news as a concept, this slow news movement that we're engaged in, some of us, is really a reaction against, at least from my point of view, against the not what's no longer the 24-hour news cycle, it's the immediate news cycle, and the lack of not just context, but substance. And there's a guy I quote in the book, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who it is. He says something regarding the immediacy of so-called news reporting now, that before there can be the reporting, there has to be the gathering. And that part is so missing. So that's what I think the less jive answer is, that there has to be the substance, and that requires gathering, not just yammering.
In terms of terrestrial radio and podcasts, what are your thoughts on the current state of things?
Well, radio has been in just ghastly freefall or extraordinary resurgence, depending on your point of view, since, well, Bill Clinton, who was the first Republican I ever voted for, that's
a joke.
Drum roll, yes. And deregulation of broadcasting in this country that occurred under his watch with his signature resulted in opening up the opportunity for primarily AM radio, but not just AM radio, to become this megaphone for the Rush Limbaugh wannabes of the world, not to mention Rush Limbaugh himself.
Highly decorated American hero at this point.
Yes, he is, right? With the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Exactly.
Incomprehensible. I have engaged in talk radio all my career, and I have exported American-style talk radio to the rest of the world. I blame myself for some of this just because the medium can be so manipulated once somebody knows how to use it. And the deregulation authorized, essentially, speaking of 24 hours, the 24-hour megaphone of lies, deceit, propaganda, self-serving, egoistic nausea that is sucked up by mindless people. Excuse me, but that is how they have to be referred to, I think, who are consuming nothing else. Mm. I listen to Rush Limbaugh for about 3 minutes, about once a week. But when somebody's listening, like to the local radio station here in town, where you've got 3 hours of Limbaugh, followed by 3 hours of a local wannabe, followed by 3 hours of, I can't keep track of their schedule right now, but one more Limbaugh-type national, and they're all saying the same thing. They're working from the same playbook each day to beat in the message of negativity and victimization combined with victimizing. Mm. This isn't healthy for us.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of podcasts in this context? And in particular, Spotify's recent deal of purchasing Joe Rogan's exclusive for $100 million.
Yeah, well, too bad you guys didn't get half of that, and then your bedroom wouldn't be so sloppy. But
ouch, it's not so bad.
No, it's not that bad. And besides, you've been gracious enough not to talk about my dirty face and hair. So the diffusion of the audience is both good and bad, I think. It allows for something like what you all are doing, and it allows for the growth of podcasting in the face of the degradation of radio, traditional radio. But one of the things we lose is a common curriculum, a community building that existed prior to the multiple voices. It's very difficult to argue against the multiple voices. It's great that you are doing what you're doing and that we can choose from so much. But if we go back a couple of generations, people would wake up in Portland, most of them listening to one guy or a couple of guys who would be on the morning show on KGW or some whatever the station was at the time that was the king. And that bound communities together. That's dangerous too, of course, because maybe they're not doing that good a job and they're just popular.
Right.
There's a convoluted answer for you.
On the subject of slowness, how do you think about it in terms of global culture generally and even American culture specifically?
Well, we're running around so fast, especially in America, but the world continues to follow us to a great extent, especially in popular culture, and journalism is part of popular culture, I think. We're running so fast. We're running so fast all the time that we just aren't spending a whole heck of a lot of contemplative time. We're not thinking. I teach at the University of Oregon in the School of Journalism and Communication. And I'll depress you first, and then I'll tell you something that is responsive to your question. Hmm. There's an introductory class that has about 300 students in it, all of them wanting to be in the journalism school, which can be journalism, public relations, and advertising, or media studies, those four possibilities, but they're entering. And my first question to them is, who read the newspaper this morning? So there are about 300 there. If I get three, I'm lucky.
Wow.
Okay, so it's no longer newspaper world. Who listened to a radio newscast today? Probably won't get three. Then a broader question, what's an important news story today? And aside from the headline, like today, maybe it would be Portland or the upcoming election, there's very little depth. Now, what my wife always tells me is that's why they're in school. And so after 4 years, supposedly, that changes. That's the bad news. The good news, in somewhat in answer to your question, one of the assignments I give, speaking of slow, is that the students have to go out. They can't be anywhere where there's somebody they know, and they have to spend an hour. with a notebook, 20 minutes listening to every sound that they can isolate and writing down what it is and how they're responding to it, 20 minutes looking and doing the same thing, and 20 minutes smelling. Mm. And this slows them down, at least for that hour, and then for an hour maybe later when they report back to their colleagues in the classroom. So that is maybe what we all need to do a little bit, is just see if we can pull out of this amazing world we're blessed to live in something besides, I can't remember the name of that idiot on Fox who's been screaming lately.
Tucker Carlson.
Yeah, thank you. Idiot is, it seems to be a word I use a lot for these guys, but they are a bunch of idiots.
Hmm. So yeah, I mean, it's this engagement with the senses and really thinking more deeply about how to explore each of the senses.
Which is kind of considered somewhat radical. I mean, this is what Black Mountain College was doing. This is what Albers was teaching. Just look. And what happens as an active practice to just look. It's so skipped over now. The possibilities that happen when you just allow that to occur.
Yeah, and that's where the stories are. There's another assignment, which is go to a specific street corner and don't come back until you have 6 stories from that street corner. And it's the same thing that you just said. Just look, just observe.
Yeah.
I took a course once several years ago that was given and probably is still given by former British Marines. And it's a survival course for journalists working in conflict zones. And one of the most important things they taught that I think serves us all, whether we're reporters, not even in conflict zones, or just regular Joes and Janes, they said, look where you don't usually look. So when you're walking down the street, you might be just looking ahead of you. Look up, see what you're seeing up in the balconies, on the rooftops, look at bushes. This is where danger could be. And if you flip that, not in the paranoia that is appropriate for trying to survive in a conflict zone, but just look, as you said, just look. And there are the stories, and there's something besides virus, 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 virus. Mm.
You're the author of Organic, A Journalist's Quest to Discover the Truth Behind Food Labeling. I wanted to bring it up in the context of COVID, in particular, like what fractures have you been seeing or thinking about in relation to our food systems? And how are you thinking about the organic label in this moment and going forward?
Well, the book looked at the organic label because my wife was doubling our grocery bill, I felt, by buying organic. And so 2 particular products came into the household. One was black beans that were from Bolivia, and the other was walnuts that came from Kazakhstan and were labeled organic, 2 of the most corrupt governments in the world. And I didn't believe that the label had the veracity that it claimed it had. And so I tracked those 2 products and found all sorts of what I perceived to be flaws in the U.S. National Organic Program. So in the context of what's going on now, speaking of paranoia, nothing comes into our house that I don't wipe down before it gets into the kitchen, because nobody knows apparently for certain how this virus is transmitted. Since mid-March, so that's however many months that is, we've not eaten in a restaurant or we haven't brought any takeout food into the house. I don't trust anybody, not because they're devious necessarily, but because we're at this bizarre stage where there is no certainty.
Yeah.
Even close.
And it's fascinating to think about that our sustenance, our food, is something that we can't trust. I mean, it's that far, it's that deep into our culture.
Yeah, everything from the labeling, so sure, they were black beans and they were walnuts. But were they organic? And what's organic anyway?
Yeah. And why is the virus still here if it's warm out? Thought it was supposed to go away.
Right. And why is there this constant change in how it can be transmitted, et cetera? Well, that's science. And so the reality is we don't know. So how are we best going to defend ourselves without paralyzing ourselves?
Mm. You've also written several books on nature and the environment, The Dangerous Worlds of Butterflies, Dreaming in Turtle, Forbidden Creatures, and No Animals Were Harmed. What's your current pulse in terms of the state of things? Are you able to remain optimistic based on all that you know?
I, in fact, get more optimistic in some ways, at least looking forward. And there are three reasons for that. One is that there's growing consciousness, I think, I feel, I believe, that the extinctions we're living through are resulting in us losing precious animals. And so we need to be cognizant of what we're doing to further those extinctions and try to reverse that or at least slow it down. Another is that we maybe still think we're top dogs, so to speak, but that there are other species that are engaged in extraordinary behaviors that we can learn from and enjoy, and they're not below us or far below us. And maybe we're even learning we're not necessarily top dog. And then the third is this growing interest in eating something other than animals, which is good news. Even for those who like to eat meat, not eating as much meat. And maybe if we're looking for some positive things, as you were suggesting earlier on in our conversation about the virus, maybe this awareness of how it probably came from another species and that we might not want to be eating bush meat and going to the wet markets that I observed in horror in Asia when I was working on the research for the turtle book. So there's some positives, I think, coming out of that. We're seeing things like zoos closing and places that trap marine mammals to show off to us being denigrated and not celebrated. Yeah, good news, positive.
Well, I wanted to get into a bit of zoos and exotic pets in general, but do you believe that human beings need to have opportunities in our sort of modern urban societies to engage in a real one-to-one, even though it's sort of asymmetrical, they're in a cage, you're not, things like that. But do you believe in that argument that we need to see them, to understand them?
Well, I mindlessly enjoyed zoos until I went with my wife and youngest son to the zoo in Heidelberg, and the elephant was in a enclosure for us to gawk at the elephant, and it was all concrete, and the elephant was just stepping forward, stepping forward in behavior that I learned later is common for caged animals. And that turned my wife into basically an anti-zoo fanatic, and she has brought me along. And that's the explanation of how I got to the point to answer your question. We don't need zoos. It's ridiculous to even consider that we need zoos. Here we are talking. There are four of us on this conversation. Who knows where the three of you are? I didn't even think to ask. And I think I know where I am. If there were no virus, would I have gotten on an airplane and flown to be with you? Is that necessary? Sure, it's nice to meet and have lunch and all of that. But we can have a engaged conversation this way, being in four different places. We can do the same regarding getting to know animals that we've got no business hanging out with, probably like elephants, unless we want to move to where they live. And there are such sophisticated cameras now that trigger the animals in the wild where we can observe them and have an understanding of them without having to grab them, trap them, and stick them in appalling conditions.
To be clear for the listeners who are probably wondering who this mystery fourth person is, he's referring to Pat, our great sound engineer.
Yes, indeed.
Tiger King became such a huge subject in the early part of COVID. I don't know if you watched it, but if you did watch it, I'm curious what it kind of revealed in your mind about our relationship to animals and how far in one direction America has gone. Did you watch it?
I know Tiger King rather intimately. Eric Good, one of the producers and directors, is a friend and a colleague. He is the founder and executive director of the Turtle Conservancy, right. And the Turtle Conservancy has been a supporter of the work that I've done, and I'm on the advisory board of the Turtle Conservancy. And I would call Eric, in fact, from places in Asia at these wet markets, and I'd email photographs to him and say, what is this turtle? Because I'm not a turtle expert. My book really is about people and people interacting with turtles. And he would then give me an answer right away. That turtle is highly endangered, completely protected. It's illegal to sell. And then I'd say to the shopkeeper, how much is the turtle? So I took advantage for sure of Eric's expertise. And I watched as he worked on developing the Tiger King, and he did a remarkable job of gaining access to these characters and what they're up to. I understand a lot of the criticism, and some of it undoubtedly appropriate, but overall, it drew and continues to draw attention to the abhorrent private zoo problems that exist across the country and the patchwork of laws that allows people in some places like Indiana and Missouri to basically do whatever they want with whatever kind of animal they want to, at the expense of the animal, jeopardizing their neighbors. And as much fun as it might be, and as amazing as it might be, I visited a couple in Nevada who, you know, I got to meet Bam Bam the lion and Princess the tiger. And this is, it's impossible for that not to be compelling on some level of the exotic and the potentially dangerous and the intriguing and the one-of-a-kind experience that I can recount now to you with a certain amount of enthusiasm and showing off. But it's not fair.
Yeah.
It's not fair. It's not fair.
Well, there's this line between entertainment and abuse, right? And we found it interesting. We had a conversation with a Trumpcast host, Virginia Heffernan, early on, right around the time Tiger King was out on Netflix. And there is this relationship between Joe Exotic and the Trump White House. And I'd love to hear from you what your perspective on maybe why Tiger King had so much impact when it did, and possibly if it explores this line between entertainment and abuse.
Yeah, I think it explores the line between entertainment and abuse, just because if you're a thinking person watching it, you're going to be thinking about entertainment and abuse. And the reason why it was such a screaming success, I think in part it was great timing. Mm-hmm. People were just suddenly locked down, as the terminology is now. And so many people, I don't quite understand it, couldn't figure out what to do with their time. And just getting to know you guys a little bit, I can't imagine you have any problem figuring out what to do with time. Time is precious. And
no, we do well in quarantine.
Yes, exactly. and yet there were people just, what am I going to do with myself? And here was this very compelling, unique show to watch and engage with. So the timing was a lot, but I think even were there no lockdown, no virus, that there would have been a big audience for this. The characters are not what you usually see in your office cubicle, and the interaction with the animals, it's impossible for it not to be, it's like a car wreck. When's the last car wreck you didn't look at?
And how close to Trump's energy did it have for you? I mean, for us, we really very much felt like Joe Exotic was kind of an archetype like Trump, and that it was a mirror to help us understand in a way half of the country that maybe we don't talk to every day and we don't completely understand that Trump is speaking directly to.
Yeah, that's not the avenue I take to try to understand who Trump is talking to, but I can see how that could be a path. I do things in a really overt way, and I think we all should. And if I can take a moment on the soapbox in answer to your question, saying one of the things that we are doing so poorly, all of us here, is having conversations across this divide. Mm-hmm. And I try to act on that. This is Lane County here, where the university is, Lane County, Oregon. And I invited the chair of the Lane County Republican Party to my class to talk with the students and for the students to talk with him. And this was unique on both sides. And that's going to be our best course moving forward, I think, is figuring out how to talk to people. You can find commonality somehow with everyone. The most, if you are, and it sounds like you are, not a Trump supporter, you can find commonality with the most ardent Trump supporter anywhere. You'll find somebody who likes audio. You'll find somebody who is a specialist in the kind of microphone you use, somebody else who didn't shave this morning like you, and you can talk about your beards. And that's what we have to do. And again, if I may talk as professors tend to, one of the things I tell my students, that's the terrible line professors use, is when you're in someplace mundane like the market, talk to the person behind you in line. And if you're buying your so-called organic walnuts and organic black beans and they're buying Wonder Bread and Twinkies, ask them why they're buying that. Just to engage across the divide, whether it's a political divide or a food divide or a what should we do with animals divide, because we can always find something. And that's what the work you're doing with this show is all about. Mm. We can always find something where we have mutual interest.
Mm. Your next book, which comes out in September, is Up Against the Wall, The Case for Opening the Mexican-American Border. How did this project come about? And tell us some of your beliefs in terms of open borders.
This project came about because I've been looking at borders and identity and migration in my work for years. And with Trump's wall being dominant the last several years in the news, and especially in the news about Mexico and migration from Mexico, I started to look at walls across time and walls across cultures. And I lived in Berlin for a year before the wall came down and a year after the wall came down. And one of the lessons is that the Berlin Wall, this ghastly gash where so many people died and all of the negativity of it is now a place to get t-shirts and ice cream cones. And and so is Hadrian's Wall. And so is the Great Wall of China. So how long is it going to be until the wall that separates us from Mexico is going to be that? And is there anything we can do to accelerate that so that we can have it be t-shirts and ice cream cones instead of border guards? And so the book is a bit of a polemic, and it I don't call for open borders worldwide, but given the history and the realities of our border with Mexico, Mexicans should be able to come up to the 48 or 50 states with the same ease that Canadians can come down. Mm-hmm. And nothing else makes any sense unless you hate Mexicans.
Yeah.
But as one of the Mexican interviewees I quote in the book said, they like our food, they like our music, they like our costumes, they just don't like us. Mm. And that's one reason why that should be open, but that border should be open. And that's what the book calls for.
It makes me think of Suketu Mehta's This Land Is Our Land, An Immigrant's Manifesto, which has this harrowing scene at the border wall. It's what he calls the Dance of the Pinkies. On one side, there's a relative, and on the other side, there's a relative. I think it's a mother and son. And the only way they can connect is by sticking their pinkies through this wall.
Yeah, it's a terrible place if it's the same one that I visited in Tijuana, San Diego line, and it's almost at the Pacific.
Right there.
And I talked to a guy who had flown down from Chicago to see a family friend he hadn't seen for 12 years. This is open for a couple of hours on Saturday and Sunday, and it was just that. The mesh is so thick that you can barely touch fingertips. It's perverse. It's just sick. And border guards are there looking over it as if somebody's going to violate this massive wall there. And of course, as Vicente Fox, who wrote the foreword to the book, says on one of his famous YouTube videos, he takes out of a folder, he's talking directly to Trump, and he takes out of a folder, he says, we've determined what it is that's going to solve this wall problem. And it's a childlike drawing of a ladder, and he looks at the camera and he says, "It's a ladder, Einstein." And it's nuts. And there will be ice cream cones and t-shirts there.
Mm.
Before we finish, can you talk with us or elaborate a little bit more on the importance of conversation? And what are some of your philosophies that you have around the art of interviewing?
Silence, key, as long as you can possibly stand it, and then a little longer, and if you're really good, you wait until the other guy fills it. But you guys are pros, and I won't win this with you guys. And then listening.
Yeah.
There is such poor listening, and you guys are great listeners, and you've let me yammer on, and all of us, or most of us, like to yammer on. But to listen, and to actively listen, and to go back to the question, why is your bedroom such a mess? And to keep going back to it and not getting pushed away. So when your partner in crime says, it's not that messy, and then I say, yeah, but that quilt on the bed would never pass military inspection. It's wrinkled. And just to go back and to force out some kind of response, graciously, one would hope, but relentlessly, and then listening, listening. And I try after decades with my wife too, to just shut up and listen to her, because so many of us want to be responsive and reactive. And if we can just listen with these active listening tools, like, and then what happened? What happened next? How come you think that occurred? And then shut up. Shut up. That's the key. Shut up and listen.
Just like Albers used to say, shut up and look.
Yeah, absolutely. 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 And we don't tend to do that because we want to be in charge, maybe, or we want to show off. It's hard to shut up. Yeah, see, I can't shut up.
Last question is, what's giving you the most hope right now as we continue through this pandemic and eventually emerge out of it?
One-on-one, we're lovely, usually, people. We really are. And human nature, I'm convinced, is mostly good. There are more of us good guys than those bad guys. And people care for each other when given the opportunity. And that gives me hope. That and Anthony Fauci.
And organic black beans?
Or even black beans that aren't organic, if they just would keep the label off of them. Yeah.
Peter, this is such a joy. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
Oh, I'm so glad to meet you guys this way, and look forward to post-virus having a beer somewhere. And I appreciate the opportunity to engage in this stimulating conversation with you.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter exploring the five senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.